Hello again, I'm Luke Clancy, and this is the Culture File Weekly Back to School Edition, with its trusty satchel filled once more with the wisdom of ages, plus some sandwiches and an apple. And this weekly we'll be going to the Church of the Dirty Gospel with bandleader Reverend Vince Anderson. We'll be straightening up our ideas of what the phrase Latin music really means, and Owen Nolan will be back with his latest slightly unreasonable point of view. But we start this week by peeling back a few layers. Wallpaper, it may be destined for background work, but look closely and it might actually reveal the plot. Historic wallpaper tells the tale of the paper stainers, or printers who made it, the merchants who traded it, and the long-gone souls who put it on their walls. And for David Skinner, wallpaper maker, conservator, and hang historian, releasing those layers of stories and the odd ghost is what life is all about. Culturefile's Eleanor Flegg met Skinner to flick through some samples of old Dublin.
There's something about the fact that in a room which has 20 layers of wallpaper in it, going back many, many years or centuries, that embodies the idea of past lives layered on top of each other, inhabiting a house, even though it's just the wallpaper that people left behind. It's the only thing that has an actual personal connection to people who lived and died there a long, long time ago. The actual hard architecture of a building, the plasterwork, the fireplaces, the doors, weren't chosen by the occupants. But the wallpaper was. They chose it for some reason or another. It reflects their personal tastes. At the same time, it's frustrating because, when you're involved in any kind of historical research, you find people, you find personalities, but you never really know very much about them. So in a sense, they're kind of like ghosts. They're there. Maybe they're trying to tell you something, but you can't really find what they're trying to tell you. You'd like to know more. These two little scraps here are from the building that now houses the Dublin Tenement Museum in Henrietta Street. They have sort of semi-abstract floral patterns on them.
All the papers are parlour, but he's no right to do so.
Typical of the 1960s. Quite possibly made in Ireland at the time. Kildare Wallpapers had a big wallpaper factory out in Kildare town producing machine-printed wallpapers. We copied this one here for the room on the ground floor in Henrietta Street that's been recreated as a tenement from the 1960s.
When father papered the parlour, you couldn't see par for pace. Dabbing it here and dabbing it there, there was paste and paper everywhere. Mother was stuck to the ceiling and the kids were stuck to the floor. You never saw such a bloomin' family so stuck up before.
So do you get called in as a wallpaper detective to peel off the layers and work out what belonged to what period and where it might have come from?
That's exactly what I do. And quite often you find layer upon layer upon layer, and sometimes you find absolutely nothing. In the north side of Dublin City, you're actually more likely to find a lot of layers of wallpaper going back through history than you would, say, in one of the south side Georgian squares, Merrion Square or Fitzwilliam Square. And the reason for that is precisely because of the different social histories of buildings on the north side and the south side of Dublin. On the north side, the grand Georgian buildings went into tenement use quite early on in the 19th century. Even before that, the wealthy people had migrated south. And for that reason, not a lot of money was spent on redecoration. Wallpaper tended to be stuck on top of the previous wallpaper in streets like Henrietta Street, whereas in somewhere like Merrion Square, people would have had money to employ expensive decorators and do a really thorough job, strip the walls completely before redecorating. So when you go into somewhere like Henrietta Street, you can find a sandwich of wallpapers which might be up to 20 wallpapers thick, and you can remove that from the wall and separate them all out. In some cases, you might actually find yourself going back into the 18th century at the bottom layers. That's kind of rare, but it has happened. There's a house at the top of Henrietta Street owned by the Daughters of Charity, and when it was restored a few years ago, it was sort of a Tutankhamun's tomb-type experience, because they, when they took over possession of the house, had covered a lot of the Georgian features, the walls, the staircase, in sheets of hardboard painted white, giving it a quite an institutional look. And then when all this was removed, in one of the rooms, there was an entire room of mid-18th century flock wallpaper still on the walls, in very poor condition, but still on the walls. Flock wallpaper was huge in the 1970s, but it was one of the first types of wallpaper to be made, used extensively in 18th century Dublin. There are references to houses on Stephen's Green with all the principal rooms being covered in flock wallpaper. It was made using finely chopped wool or sometimes silk fibre, which was chopped up until it was as fine as dust. And then instead of printing a colour onto the wallpaper, they printed an adhesive, varnish perhaps, and then scattered the wool dust onto the wet varnish. And that's how they made flock wallpaper then. It hasn't actually changed much. Now, there are machines that do it now, or you can do it by hand. We do it by hand. We make flock wallpaper. In fact, we don't really like making flock wallpaper because it is an unbelievably messy operation and potentially hazardous to the health, obviously, from inhaling this fine dust that's floating around in the air. So when we make it, we have to put on full breathing apparatus, like, you know, we're working in a radioactive cleanup site or something like that. This is rather nice. This is a nursery wallpaper. It shows nursery rhymes, a kind of a perennial theme on Victorian children's wallpapers. So this would have been fairly cheaply produced, machine printed. We've got little Bo Peep here, and this is, here we go around the mulberry bush, and this is, where are you going to, my pretty maid?
He looks sleazy.
He does look very sleazy.
It's got little holes in it, is that?
It's got little holes in it, yeah.
Is that wallpaper worm?
Yeah, it is. It's a wallpaper worm. Lots of insects like to eat wallpaper. There's a 18th century wallpaper in Louisa Connolly's bedroom in Castletown House, just scraps of it left on the wall. And the insects have eaten all the wallpaper except the pattern, because whatever pigment was in the pattern wasn't to their liking. So all the white bits of paper have been eaten around, so the pattern is left like a bit of lace clinging to the wall.
David Skinner there talking to Eleanor Flegg. David Skinner's recreation of 1960s wallpaper is on display in the Dublin Tenement Museum. Or to find out more, see skinnerwallpaper.com.
It's autumn, inevitably, season of mists and geopolitical showdowns. But on the plus side, the return of the concert series Autumn Sounds by duo Chagall. Gillian Williams and Aaron Rao began Autumn Sounds back in 2011, and this year it's spread to four different venues across Fingal in North Dublin and added a 16-piece chamber orchestra. Programmes for the nights will showcase, among other works, some buried treasures of Latin classical music. Ornya Gallagher sat in on rehearsals with Joao Chagall, joined by Marco Ramelli on guitar, to sample the series.
Our programme is a strange mixture of Mediterranean music from Spain, Italy, and from South America. And so altogether, all of that, I suppose, can be tagged as Latin, even though nowadays people have an understanding of Latin that is somewhat different from the classical literature. But classical music has a very rich amount of music written for strings, and the inclusion of a guitar, I think, is particularly relevant in calling it Latin.
Gillian Williams, part of duo Chagall with cellist Aaron Rao and myself, violinist. We're getting together to resume our series, Autumn Sounds, an annual series that we've been doing for about 9 years.
All of these concerts happening on the north side of the Liffey, which is quite an unusual thing.
Yes, it's probably one of the inspirations for Aaron and I, living on the north side of the Liffey. I've been born in Dublin 15. I've spent my childhood there. And it's true, I think the south side and, of course, in town get all the treats, the musical treats and highlights and delights. And as we've been part of the performing world for years now, there was time for something new. And with the inspiration of being a native Fingal girl, I decided it was time there was music here. This year, it's a particularly wonderfully exciting venture because finally there has been a budget for us to be able to launch a chamber orchestra for Fingal. We have 16 players, you know, mostly based in Fingal. That said, being based in Fingal doesn't necessarily mean they're from North Dublin or they're from Dublin at all. They're from all over the world, as well as a few natives like myself.
At the core of our programs was the notion that we wanted to include the guitar in a string context. So it started really with this notion that the Italian composer Niccolo Paganini had written quite a number of works that included guitar in a chamber music setting. And we went for the terzetto, which is actually the only trio he wrote that includes violin, cello, and guitar. The other two are for a viola, guitar, and cello. This one so has its own very specific sounds and textures, and based on that, it allowed us to maybe branch into the solo string route. So Gillian and I are playing this Villa-Lobos composition, which is not heard very often. In fact, I think we're the only duet on the planet to play it. I don't think there's even a recording for it. This was a piece that he composed quite late in the cycle of Shauros, which is I suppose you could call it the alpha and the omega of his production. He essentially wanted to capture the sounds of his native Brazil, but he also incorporated Western compositions. And this is almost like an afterthought to his cycle of 14 Shauroses. It's called Shauros bis, French for encore.
With these composers that are adding for guitar and bowed strings, do they emphasize the difference between, or do they tend to use percussive sounds on the violin and cello in order to complement? How are they going about it?
I think the music for strings is really well written for these instruments. The cello music in particular is sometimes, yeah, a bit exotic, but I think these composers, even though Villa-Lobos was a cellist, I think he wasn't afraid to experiment with the cello and to even bring out some strange effects. There's a percussive effect, as you mentioned. It's a crossing of strings, and I think it's the only time ever in the whole literature that I've come across it. So you cross over the middle strings, and then you strum, but those middle strings are actually going to produce some sort of rattling noise. So obviously, when you pluck the four strings, and they all ring, but plucking them and crossing them makes this sort of sound. So you cross repeatedly, and the middle is really very, very tambourine-like. So that was really quite a strange effect.
How's that even notated?
I think he had to write the instruction underneath. I don't think he noted the crossing, because, I mean, there's no distinct pitch to any of this. And then conversely, how the guitar is brought in to mix with the strings is quite different to the guitar repertoire. But I think for us string players, and Gillian is also playing very lyrically up in the top of the Villa-Lobos Shauro, there are things that are quite unusual about those compositions.
Actually, it was surprising. The guitar works very, very well with violin and cello. And in Paganini, he used the guitar to accompany the two instruments, but also to give a different flavor for some melodies. And actually, we know that Paganini was the guitar player in the ensemble. We have a few paintings of Paganini playing the guitar in the ensemble. And because he was also a great guitarist, and he wrote more than... actually, more works for guitar than the violin.
It's so unusual, because I never knew that he played the guitar.
He never played the guitar in concert. He always played the violin. But he started very young to play the guitar and the mandolin, And then he continued throughout his life.
With all of this Latin classical music, would I be wrong in saying that it seems a little bit closer than maybe standard classical music to the landscape, more drenched in the folklore?
The Boccherini Quintet for guitar and strings, especially the last movement, the Fandango, is a legendary movement among all his works, because it was probably the most flavored of all of these folky movements, if you want to describe them as folky. There you really have the original folk movement in classical music. The Fandango was a dance that usually involved a couple, and the castanets were part of the performance. But the castanets are such a striking effect in it that suddenly you're immediately transported. It's just a different experience to what one might expect from a classical music concert.
That was Gillian Williams and Aaron Rao of Gio Chagall, along with Marco Ramelli. The Autumn Sounds concert series will begin this weekend on Saturday the 7th in the Grand Hotel Malahide at 8 p.m, on Sunday the 8th at 4 p.m. in Ard Gillan Castle, Balbriggan, with further outings Thursday the 12th in the Drieck Theatre and Friday the 13th in Farmley House in the Phoenix Park.
Next, have you got a new idea? Well, an old one then, that'll do, just as long as you nail the big presentation, as our regular brand wrangler Owen Nolan notices in his very latest, very slightly unreasonable point of view.
Not the shock of the new, more the shock of the attachment in the 42nd email. The Hudsucker Proxy is a Coen Brothers comedy from 1994 and set in 1950s New York. In it, Tim Robbins plays the hero, or anti-hero, Norval Barnes. Norval is a naive business school graduate working in the mailroom of Hudsucker Industries, a vast manufacturing company, when he is suddenly installed as president in a The Producer-style stock scam. Norval is a patsy who is being set up to fail, but he's a patsy with an idea. At every opportunity, Norval shows his big idea to people on a scrap of paper. It's a simple drawing of a circle, and Norval explains enthusiastically, if enigmatically, with the single phrase, you know, for kids. As it transpires, Norval has invented the hula hoop. It gets made because the evil manipulator who is setting up Norval for failure, Paul Newman in a rare role as baddie, assumes it's an idiot's idiotic idea. But after a dismal start, the hula hoop becomes a sensation. In real life, the hula hoop was invented. There are quotation marks around the word invented there in case you couldn't hear them, in 1958 and produced by Wham-O in California. The hula hoop became a craze, a resounding success, which is more than can be said for the Hudsucker Proxy at the box office, which has had to rely instead on its cult status. The reason for the quotes around the word invented was that the hula hoop had been around in one form or another for thousands of years, made from reed, papyrus, wood or metal. There was even a previous hula hoop craze in 14th century England, though it wasn't going to be called a hula hoop for another 500 years. Yet the fact that an idea might have surfaced previously is not inherently a problem for an idea. As Mies van der Rohe said, it's better to be good than to be original. The history of inventions, like the Walkman, the car, or the mobile phone, teems with examples of one person's idea being perfected or made viable by another, while science is often a process of fusion and parallel evolution. Messrs. Nur and Mellon, founders of Wham-O, wouldn't have had to draw the hula hoop and say, you know, for kids, as it was a straight build on an Australian exercise hoop made of bamboo, with the name hula hoop coming partly from a Native American hoop dance. Even though the hula hoop was an enormous success, Wham-O's next hit was to prove even more successful, the Frisbee. Frisbees had commercial advantages over the hula hoop. Unlike the hoop, the frisbee was thrown and so could get lost. Plus, dogs liked frisbees more than they liked hula hoops, and a chewed frisbee needs replacing. So here we are in the information age, and it might be presumed that the presentation and communication of ideas has progressed beyond 20th century scraps of paper. But no. At least not so much in advertising. Ideas were once presented, if not with fanfare, then in a way that commanded appropriate attention. Artwork was mounted on board and lovingly covered with a protective layer of tracing paper, with a hinge fashioned from masking tape. In holding the board and lifting the veil, a sensual appreciation of the work was triggered. The gaze was directed. if a campaign were presented, the rituals of theatre, tease and reveal, created anticipation and excitement. The shock of the new happened regularly, and it was a welcome and exhilarating sensation, excitement and fear co-mingling. Now, when everybody's too busy to do their job properly, most email goes unread, or worse, unanswered, and ideas are sent in files to be downloaded and shared. They're viewed in haphazard conditions on poor monitors in noisy open plan offices by people who are only allowed to say no. Even when they are approved, they're rarely improved. Too much is as facile as mud, and no one has to explain, you know, for kids.
Owen Nolan of Brand Artillery there with a slightly unreasonable point of view. And finally on this edition of the Culture File Weekly, are you ready to let the Reverend Vince into your heart? Or more immediately, your ears? Reverend Vince and his band, The Love Choir, have a great fidelity to place and one of New York's longest-running residencies, at which the Rev puts on a weekly concert service, singing songs about God and love and food and passing his big, big hat after every set. But Reverend Vince left the city over the summer for a visit to Ireland to officiate at a tiny basement bar in Dublin, where Culture File's Louis Scully went to hear the Reverend testify.
My name's the Reverend Vince Anderson. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, born in California. I'm a musician. I play a kind of music I call dirty gospel. I first developed an interest in music. I think my mom tells me I was 3. I started sitting at the piano and just pounding on it. And I would pound and just... not too much different than what I do now. So I actually learned how to play piano before I knew how to read. My early memories of performing were actually in the church. I was raised Lutheran, so I started playing in church at a very, very young age. I took my first job as a music director when I was 11. I am an ordained reverend, so that's part of my professional life. And to me, there's no separation, really. Like, it's all ministry in some shape or form of, like, making sure that people are taken care of and feel loved, whether I'm doing that in a more pastoral sense or if I'm doing it from the stage. The goal is the same. It's to make people feel a little less loved.
Now Moses had a problem. People were enslaved, worked all day under the hot desert sun, never once got paid.
So I call my music Dirty Gospel, and the reason for that is kind of twofold. One is there's the theological side. I mean, the word gospel means truth, so it's dirty truth. All music is gospel music because it's anything that comes from the heart is true. The theology behind it is that we take this gospel, this kind of the divine, the heavens, the, you know, and bring it back down to earth, back down to the dirt, back down to the mud, you know, earthy gospel, like all of our big ideas, all of our big thoughts, the divine, whatever it is, and just kind of bring it back down to humanity. And so that's what I mean by dirty gospel. Musically, I'm influenced by the Delta and the Great Mississippi River that cuts through the United States from Chicago to New Orleans. So this muddy, this gigantic muddy river from Chicago blues to Memphis soul down to New Orleans jazz, like, and all points in between is where the roots of my musical leanings are. The dirty gospel, the dirty Mississippi. And that also describes the music we play. Gospel, just to say gospel, people came expecting something else and were, you know, pretty disappointed. They were coming just expecting that. So for a while I called it gospel noir. That was maybe when it was a little darker too, and over the last 25 years, my music's become lighter. Not lighter in weight, but a point to light rather than darkness, I think, for the most part. I've been doing it for 25 years, so pretty quickly into that time, I came up with this phrase, Dirty Gospel. And it seemed to work. I could say Dirty Gospel and people would nod their heads and say, I don't have any idea what that means, but I understand what it means. We've been performing in Brooklyn every Monday night for the last 23 years. And we just celebrated 10 years at one club at this place called Union Pool in Brooklyn. The meat and potatoes of our musical life are these Mondays, because it's just our living room and it's where we can really spread out, and you know, and it's like church. It's, you know, we do it every week, and so there's a liturgy, there's a, you know, do similar songs, but everything's always a little different, and this community gathers, we call it the on Monday nights we call it the Church of the Holy Unruly. Our next hymn is 642. Say amen when you got it.
Amen. Amen.
It's really a place where people can come and kind of just let go of their identity for a little bit, let go of themselves, and you know, and I'm not asking people to go to church, but that's in effect what we're doing in some semblance of that.
Reverend Vince Anderson there with an introduction to Dirty Gospel. Louis Scully was the reporter, and that brings to an end this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more soulful testimony at 7 p.m. next Friday. Until then, bye now.